to GalacticConnection.com, one of the most popular blogs on the World Wide Web today for alternative news. Stay tuned for the latest information on our world shift from enslavement to galactic involvement, as well as current intel on any blockages impeding us from our sovereign birthright. Knowledge and self-mastery are key at this time. Our commitment is to present you with the latest breaking conspiratorial articles, off-world messages, exopolitics, cutting-edge technologies and sciences, and also an ever-significant intertwining of spiritual support and metaphysical scope that one needs to dive down the rabbit hole and search for truth with balance. We are truly on the horizon of a new golden age filled with the promise for more love, worldwide peace, and accelerated intuitive skills, where every living being can exist in cohesion and abundance. It is whatever we envision and dream this new world to be. I say to you now, let's redefine the new world to the beginnings of our own precious heaven on Earth. Galactic Connection is here to provide the pulse of Mother Earth through an eclectic range of interviews each Tuesday afternoon from 3 to 4:55 p.m., Pacific Standard Time, Station 2 on BBS Radio, expanding your perspectives on how we can once and for all take back our freedoms, our joy, and our connection with our mighty I Am presence. Our intention remains true to connect hearts and minds everywhere in order to obtain global unity and galactic and universal acceptance. Our discussions will continue to cover anything to do with galactic society and our involvement with our galactic brothers and sisters. Our guests are experts in their fields, and our radio shows have been coined as some of the most thought-provoking out there. In addition to our daily blog, which runs 365 days a year, we also offer a realm of healing services such as our world-renowned implant removal processes, our spiritual past life clearings, our galactic violet ray alchemy from Alexandra, who shares in the lineage of Merlin, and other cutting-edge healing technologies. Check our site out at galacticconnection.com now. Sending you a wave of light, love, and inspiration, and a personal hug and thank you for listening to our Galactic Connection radio show and visiting our blog today. Hello, everyone. This is Alexandra Metters of GalacticConnection.com, and today is a pre-recorded interview for May 31st, 2016. So today we're going to be interviewing again Scott Walter, because we really kind of got cut off last time, and I really want to dive into more of his experience with the Knights Templars. And before doing that, I just wanted to thank everyone for their support, their emails, their articles, their pictures, all the cool things that are coming in that support us and allow us to be able to send that information out to the world and share it with all of you. I do want everyone to know I was out of town last week. I am a little bit behind. I was at a First Contact conference, and it was a private conference where we were discussing ways in which we can prepare the world for our galactic brothers and sisters to come and hang out with us. We also got quite a bit of information on just being educated on all kinds of a variety of subjects, and it was just very, very inspiring, to say the least. I also feel that I want everyone to really hunker down. Please, once again, if you have not built the three-sided pyramids over your locations, over key areas that you feel are important for the planet, over the institutions that you feel are very dark, please do this. Folks, this is so imperative and extremely assistant for the planet. I cannot stress that enough. The people that are doing it, they can really feel a difference. You will feel a difference if you're on, like, let's say it's an old Indian burial ground and you happen to find your house on top of that. You know, it just can do absolute wonders. But most importantly, we really want to remove as much darkness as possible from underground, especially, And if you can continue doing this, and those of you who haven't delved into it, please check our website. We do have a pre-record that you can refer to. Very simple process. Everyone can do it. And you would be really helping all of us, seriously. And I mean all of us, okay? So as always, I'm going to go ahead and give you a brief introduction on Scott. Scott Walter is an author, a researcher, and a television host, and known best for his hosting the series called America Unearthed. He has also been the founder and president of the American Petrographic Services and the inventor of the archaeopetrography, which I kind of still want to get a little bit more into that this time around. He was involved in analyzing the concrete remains of the World Trade Center over 9/11. And because of this, he has just been severely, and I mean severely, attacked on the internet. So keep your eyes open. As I said before, if you see a lot of the attacking and a lot of the derision and a lot of the maligning of individuals, remember what is the true purpose of that? What is the true agenda of that? We are at a time we must stop just doing modus operandi like we've always done before. We are shifting into a new earth. We're shifting into a completely new paradigm. And therefore, if something triggers us, if something irritates us, if something offends us, we really need to go within and ask ourselves, what is it about us that's offended or triggered or upset or irritated? And we are being called for our accountability. How do we respond to getting upset? How do we respond to getting irritated with others? How do we address that situation in the highest and most professional and the best way possible? Sometimes it's best to just keep your mouth shut altogether. Sometimes it's best to just excuse yourself from the situation gracefully and allow the universe to unfold, because we are definitely in a time zone here where if you put something out that is really nefarious or derogatory or negative and you're not thinking about the repercussions of that, it is going to come back and haunt you. Unfortunately, that's the way this world works. Maybe it is fortunate, right? So we are really getting booted in the you-know-what to become more accountable for our own actions, our own thoughts, the way that we relay information about others. It's super, super important. So it's important that we also remember, yes, we stay in our own honesty. We stay in our own discernment. Okay, this is not about not being able to discern. The fact that we see life the way we do, we're still going to be making judgments, meaning, you know, is it red or is it blue? Okay, we can't avoid that by the fact of this being a dualistic environment. But we can, however, pull back and really evaluate the way in which we're affected by that information. And this is the core of the Galactic Connection blog, is to really help all of us get to that place of neutrality. This is really, truly what we are striving for, to become more galactic in our lens, to become more accepting and allowing of what others say, that we don't necessarily agree with it, but we don't have to agree with it. And that doesn't mean that we have to get defensive, and it doesn't mean that we have to go on the attack. So the more of us that do this, the more of us that stand in our strength, and that means like being strong about what you believe, what you feel, what you think, and being okay that somebody else is not in that same box as you. So anyway, just had to get that off my chest. Anyway, so Scott's first appearance on the television was regarding the Kensington runestones, which is just fascinating. These were discovered in Minnesota back in 1898. And he then created a documentary called Holy Grail in America. So we're going to kind of dive in today a little bit more about the Knights Templar and his perceptions on what he's found. Amazing trail of connections between the pirates, the Templar, and also Jesus and Mary and the family. So stay tuned. We'll be on in just a few minutes and have a wonderful, wonderful afternoon. Okay, everyone. Scott had technical issues and he couldn't get his computer to work. And so he was able to at least call in. So Scott, say hi to everyone.
Hello, everybody. I'm really sorry. I got a new computer and I got tangled up. What can I say?
You know what? I'm glad you got a new computer because the last time I was interviewing you, I noticed that your screen was fading in and out.
Yep, and it was past time. I could hear my hard drive grinding, and when it starts to make noise, it's not a good thing.
Oh, no, that's not a good thing.
No.
Well, so I am not, frankly, aware of exactly where we left off last time, Scott, but I know that we started diving into the Knights Templar, and this is a subject that is so near and dear to my heart. I really thought it would be cool to bring you back on where if we go over an hour mark, we're not, you know, freaking out because an hour just flies by.
Oh, yeah.
So where do you want to begin? Because I know that you have been on this journey for a while. And I think the first question right out the gate is what caused you to be so motivated to pursue the background and the history of the Knights Templar?
Well, it wasn't so much of a motivation as it was a necessity as I was working on the Kensington Runestone, because it didn't take long for me to realize that that's exactly where the investigation went. It went directly to them. And it started by following the language, the runes, the dialect, the grammar, the whole thing. And it led right to Gotland, which was 100% Cistercian as far as the clergy there. And we know that the only people in the 14th century capable of carving an inscription of the length and complexity and the multi dimensions that are within it that I now realize would have been a member of the clergy, and because the common people weren't educated. And the only clergy we had back then were the Cistercians. And that's when I began to dive into the white monks, and they were the ones that founded the Knights Templar. Saint Bernard de Clairvaux wrote the charter for the order in 1128, and a papal bull was passed at the Council of Troyes in January of 1129, and that's when they became an official order. However, subsequent research told me that they had been around for longer than that, much longer than that, several years prior. And so that's how it happened. It went right from the runestone to the Cistercians and the Templars.
What have you found as far as the connection, you know, because there's such a gap of time according to historical documents of when Christ was actually walking the planet versus when the Knights Templar, you know, began to band together. Have you found anything that actually makes reference to why there's a gap between those two time frames?
Well, I mean, when you say there's a gap, I'm not really sure what you mean by that, because the reality is that there was a physical bloodline from that descended from Jesus and his wife Mary Magdalene and other family members from the first century that continued on through medieval times right up to today. I mean, there's probably tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people who are descendant of Jesus and Mary. That's my guess. I don't know that for sure, but I know that there are many of them. And, you know, this has been something that's been speculated for a long time. And of course, many people have argued and debated and, oh, this is impossible. And I don't understand why it's such a big deal. I mean, it's a fact that everybody walking on the planet today, all 7 billion of them, have ancestors that were alive 2,000 years ago. That's a fact. So why is it such a stretch that these two people and their families, family members, couldn't have descendants alive today? I mean, in fact, it's very plausible and it's likely. So to me, it's not a big stretch. I mean, the reason people get excited is because of who this person is and what his supposed story is. Now, the church has one story of painting this guy out to be the son of God and some divine being, but if you put if you put faith on the sidelines for a second and you just look at it pragmatically, it's really a silly notion. I mean, he's just a person like everybody else. I think he was a very important person. I think there were things that made him unique and special, but at the end of the day, he was a man, and his wife was a woman just like everybody else on the planet, in my humble opinion.
Interesting. And let me rephrase what I was actually alluding to, and that is, what have you found in your research as far as the bloodline between the time of Christ and the time that the Knights Templar began?
Well, we have groups of, we have family members, or I should say families of people who were involved in, well, first of all, I think we can look at certain genealogies and we can see that there are people that appear to descend from these people. We have DNA evidence that suggests these connections. But if you look at these people throughout time and throughout history, they have a consistent ideology that they constantly were trying to preserve and protect that was diametrically opposed to not just the Roman Church, but other forces at work that were trying to control these people and their assets. And so, you know, this is a push-pull that you have that goes on with all kinds of cultures, all kinds of people, and it's just a never-ending battle. But these Venus families, as we call them, have been involved in some of the most important historical events in recorded history as we go through time. And when you start to put together some of these family threads, you see these people showing up time and again in very important positions involved in some of the most important historical events in history, such as people like Bernard de Clairvaux, who joined the Cistercian order in 1113 with 30 family members, including uncles who were some of those original nine knights that legend has it went to the Holy Land in 1109 and was there for nine years. In 1118, they left the Holy Land and reportedly had dug under the Temple Mount and discovered fantastic treasures. Now, that's a fantastic legend. The question is it true? Mm-hmm. I personally think it is. I'm 100% confident that it is. But the point is that these people were all related, these 30 family members. And in fact, what I believe is that it should be known as the greatest coup d'etat in history that nobody knows about. And there's no question that the Cistercian order and the Knights Templar rose to prominence. They became the most successful and powerful military monastic order in history. That nobody's going to question that. And the question is, how did they do it? Why did they do it? Those are the questions that are not answered. There's one perspective on that from a Roman Christian standpoint, but I can guarantee you these people were anything but Roman Christian. In fact, they were the opposite of that, and that was their ideological enemy, but they chose to align with them. And I think many people will understand and appreciate, keep your friends close, keep your enemies closer.
I was going to say, Scott, I think that there's no question in my mind that they used the Roman Catholic Church at the time for obvious reasons to position themselves and to be able to receive the placement of sovereignty from taxation. I mean, from everything I've read, it's almost as if what they found at the temple, and supposedly it took them 9 months to get to the Vatican to present some information to them. If you read between the lines, it's so major what they found that they pretty much had the Vatican by the you-know-what.
Well, I believe that, well, look, the evidence is consistent and the evidence is clear. The interpretation, to me, there's really only one interpretation. Somebody went into the Telpiah tomb in the at the time of the First Crusade, and they went in with reverence. They took the bones of Jesus and Mary to use as insurance against the church. That's what they had against them. They could have proved or put serious doubt in the minds of people about the divinity of Jesus by having his physical remains, and Whether they ever exercised it privately or not, I guess we'll never know. But I think that was part of what gave them the power that they had over the Roman Church. But they also had other knowledge. And that was through documents, I believe, and maps and technology. Knowledge is the most important thing. But they knew about the other lands that were across the ocean, and they knew what was there, including great wealth. And they had strategic allies in the Native Americans. But this was another thing that they had, but they kept it very quiet, very secret. And, of course, people say, well, where's the evidence of that? Well, the Kensington Runestone is absolutely a Cistercian Templar document, and it should be treated with more respect instead of being dismissed and treated like historical garbage as academia does right now and have done for the past century. I mean, it's amazing to me that there isn't more intellectual curiosity. There is no evidence to prove that it's a hoax. And in fact, all the evidence proves that it's a medieval document. And it's mind-boggling why people are so resistant to accepting that fact. You go on Wikipedia, and they have sanitized that and other sites that suggest pre-Columbian contact. It's just amazing. I mean, the public can't get the straight story on it. It's sad.
Well, you know, part of that too is like once they accept that that's not true, they have to accept that so many other things that they have been spoon-fed throughout their education is all a lie too.
Well, that's you're 100% right. And I say this all the time. The minute they accept the Kensington Runestone, they trigger a bunch of lines of dominoes to fall. And those dominoes go to places that many people don't want to go, like the Talpiot tomb and the proof of the humanity of Jesus. I mean, to me, it's not a big deal, but to the church, obviously, they don't want to go there. But quite frankly, they've known this the whole time. This is the myth of Jesus that they've been perpetuating for 1700 years since the Council of Nicaea. And it's
well, don't you think too, I mean, the underground vault under the Vatican alone, I mean, basically they're holding all of this information and history.
Well, of course they are. And I don't know why there isn't an international tribunal to hold them accountable.
Exactly.
I mean, why do they have this sovereignty that they can hold on to documents that are pertinent to human history like it belongs to them? I mean, to me, it's sickening. And
ludicrous.
If you're not hiding anything, let's go. Show us what you got.
Well, so let me ask you this about the Ark of the Covenant. Do you feel, number one, that they actually found that under the temple? And number two, you do? Okay.
Oh, yeah, sure they did.
Okay. And number two, do you feel that it is actually a device of an off-world nature?
I don't know. I don't have enough information to say anything in that regard. I know a lot of people have speculation about what it may have been used for, a monatomic energy source and all those things. And I guess that's possible, but I don't have enough information to say one way or the other.
Okay.
I guess it really doesn't matter. If it was sacred to a group of people for whatever reason, it's sacred. And it became a very powerful and motivational inspiration for people. So having control over that gave you a certain amount of power and prestige. And so that would have been one of the things that they would have found and they would have probably taken too.
Yeah, oh, definitely. Now, you also mentioned the covert relations with the Indians. Can you kind of expound upon that? I would love to hear how was the relationship between the Templars? Are you just referring to the American Indians or perhaps all Aboriginal folks?
Well, I think it would have been universal. The thing that's really important is the ideology of the leadership of the Templars was not Catholic. It was monotheistic dualism. Dualism is the concept of opposites that keep things in balance. And, I can't think of another culture in the world that lives in balance with its environment better than, in this case, Native Americans. So they would have had a compatible ideology. They would have understood each other at a level that the Vikings wouldn't have understood. The Vikings were jerks, and they were they did not get along in general with Native American cultures. And according to what I've heard, they were killed and wiped out. And that's why their settlements didn't take hold. But the Templars shared a similar ideology, and they understood the way to be successful here was to literally share your blood and intermarry, create strategic alliances. And it's a fact at that time, there's no way you're going to have any success. You sure as hell aren't going to get to Minnesota unless you have a wampum or a pass to operate on this continent through the Native Americans. And they absolutely had that. And that's one of the things that I don't understand why nobody ever seriously considered that or even thought about it, because they never even got to that point because they couldn't accept that the runestone was real. Therefore, nobody went to Minnesota, but in fact, they did. I mean, the Native Americans know this.
Yes.
They know all about the people that were here. They certainly know about the Templars because their rituals are identical. Mm-hmm. And it was the Smithsonian Institute that recorded their rituals in the 1800s of the Madewin, the Algonquin tribes, and they are absolutely 100% identical. And as an investigator, I've studied these. I presented in detail these rituals and compared them in my latest book. And the only thing that could have happened is that either these rituals developed independently on two different continents at the same time, which is unlikely, or there was contact. I mean, obviously, the simple answer is there was contact. And this is what the natives say, and this is what some of the Templars say. So, and they're not gone. I mean, Templarism is alive and well, I can promise you that.
I totally agree with you.
Well, I know it for a fact. Yes. And so, but the natives, look, they don't care what white people think. And who can blame them? I mean, that little genocide thing was a problem. And so, and quite frankly, many academics are despised even more. And it's funny because the academics are the ones that attack me and say that I'm a racist because I suggest that there were white races that came from other continents here to you know, North America. I don't understand why that's racist. I really don't. But this is one of the techniques that they use to attack, to immediately put people on the defensive, and have them start backpedaling because nobody wants to be called a racist. But I just asked them, really? I'm a racist? Why am I a racist? What about suggesting pre-Columbian contact makes me a racist? Mm-hmm. I said, the Native Americans that I deal with don't think I'm a racist. They've embraced me. Some of them have treated me with some of the highest respect that they can. And all I'm trying to do is get to the truth. But if you know the right people to talk to, look, they know all about the white people that came here. But they don't care about what we think. And they resent the fact that many academics are trying to tell the world about their culture.
Yes.
When you know, and they were the ones that dug in their mounds and collected the remains of their ancestors. And I tell you what, how would we feel if the same thing happened to us, if somebody went and dug up my father or my grandfather or my grandparents? I'd be pissed off too.
Yes.
So, you know, academia is completely dishonest in their argumentation. Either that or they're incredibly naive or stupid to think that that the natives don't know anything. I mean, give me a break. They know all about it.
You know what, Scott? That's becoming more and more exposed as to, it's just another vehicle of another avenue to control the thoughts of the masses. And they're, mm-hmm. what better avenue to use than the educational system? So,
of course,
it's all part of the matrix. You know, I mean, I'm not surprised at all, nor should anybody that's listening to this interview. But I wanted to go back to the pre-Columbian contact. Can you tell us a little more about what you found as far as the contact at that time?
Well, I mean, if you're talking about the Templar period, I mean, that began in earnest really in the latter part of the 12th century. And there were many secret trips that took place here. And the natives were their strategic allies that helped them you know, I mean, when they went from tribe to tribe, you have to have basically a pass, or you have to have somebody guide you and introduce you and let people know that you're okay. And so, and the Templars went all over this continent. My gosh, they were everywhere. And so we know that that happened, but, you know, they wanted to keep that alliance quiet because in large part, they were trying to hide from the church and they wanted to set up a secret sanctuary. And this was the sanctuary. It was began by the Templars and the job was finished by the Freemasons. And in case anybody hasn't figured it out, is there an ideological connection between the two? Of course there is.
Yes.
And anybody that wants to deny that is simply, is just simply dreaming. Even many Masons don't fully understand, appreciate, or accept that there is that connection. But, it's there.
Yeah.
It's absolutely there. And I believe that our founding fathers, certain members of our founding fathers, like Thomas Jefferson and Ben Franklin, perhaps George Washington as well, knew about these early trips here and probably knew about the runestone and some of the other land claims that were placed here. And they just kept it quiet. It was part of a continuous thread that was passed on mouth to ear over the centuries with certain secret societies.
Yeah, and you know, that mouth to ear is just a classic example of the highly enlightened way that secret societies would share information. It was never written.
That's right.
It was from master
right.
teacher and therefore also honoring the perception of the student itself. What did the perception of the student bring to that information and that knowledge?
Well, and I think people need to keep in mind that when you're talking about natives or Freemasonry or Templarism or any secret society, any enlightened group of people, when you are invited into an order, whether it's a Native American, a Masonic order, whatever, first of all, it's an honor and a privilege. Mm-hmm. And you are paying attention. And this information that's passed on to you is very important. It's not so much what the information is. The point is, can you keep it secret? And so it's, as I said, you know, the initiate is paying attention. You know, a lot of people and even some academics have dismissed this oral tradition as the telephone game. And, you know, it's there's no way that this information could have remained intact over generations and centuries. And that's just simply nonsense. I mean, is it going to be preserved in a perfect way? No. But the basic message and understandings are preserved. And it's not the telephone game at all. Because usually this information is passed on during a ritual where there's a lot going on. So it's a multi-sensory experience. And when this information is passed on, you're paying attention. And you are, it's a privilege, it's an honor to receive this information, to be part of these groups. And anyone who calls it the telephone game is insulting the people that they're talking about.
Right, and not appreciating the true beauty and gift that you're being given just by the opportunity to hear the information in the first place, let alone be a possible selected party to participate.
Absolutely, you know, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that's always intrigued me a great deal is how many YouTube videos, how many books have been written about the Knights Templar, and how much information now is being dispersed out there about how they actually were part of the Baphomet. And they were actually worshiping supposedly a goat head that spoke to them. Do you have any comments on that?
Well, I think you've couched it. I think it's an oversimplification. That's not really what's going on. No, and I think I will just leave that one alone. To be honest with you, right now, I don't want to perpetuate that because it's not accurate.
Right.
Yeah. But that's, you know, it's like anything else. When one group that's opposed to another group, one of the things they do is they're going to perpetuate negative propaganda and make them sound like these people are crazy or there's something wrong with them. And that's just, and that's part of it. In this case, that's not at all what it is. It's a deliberate misinterpretation of something else.
So, Scott, let me ask you this. At the time of the so-called torturing and inquisition of the remaining Templars that were stayed behind. Now, from what I've read, which really resonates with me, thousands upon thousands actually escaped this edict and very secretively.
They were tipped off. They were tipped off prior to the arrest.
Okay. And I agree with that. And, you know, I do believe in past lives. I'm not sure if that's something that you believe in, but I do believe that that did occur and that thousands of people were able to, you know, basically flee before it got really bad. But my point is, I read in one book that was it 66 that remained behind?
No. At the time of the arrest order, we have the names of the knights that were arrested, and I think it was like 600 something in France, and I think like two in England. But the Templars were a multi-nation, multi-international organization. So, for example, in Portugal and Spain, they were unaffected. In Scandinavia, they were unaffected. In many other countries, Italy, and it goes on, they weren't affected at all physically by the put down. Now, they were persona non grata at that time, and they were officially disbanded by the Pope. But you can't kill an ideology. You can kill people, but you can't kill a belief system.
Right.
That belief system continued on. It just went underground. And in fact, in Portugal, the Templars were fighting the Moors who were attacking the south, and they were the hired military for the King and Queen of Portugal. And they basically said, what do you think? I'm going to disband my army? Forget it. So all they did was to appease the church. They changed their name to the Order of Christ, and they continued on. So in fact, the Knights Templar Order was never officially completely disbanded. They continued on in Portugal for another 500 years. So there's all kinds of details that people don't understand and don't talk about. And to say that the Templars did not exist after that is just BS. Fact that they weren't outward about their operations. I mean, they were, you know, and their base of operations was in France, and so it was a serious blow to the order. But did they completely, you know, become disbanded and destroyed and disappeared? Absolutely not.
Well, I think what I'm trying to say is that thousands of them escaped, and they actually made a decision that a certain number of them, I'm not saying generally all of them, but I think a certain number of them already knew that they were going to face this as their death so that they could protect the other thousands.
Well, yeah, I think some of the knights, probably a lot of them, were elderly, and Jacques de Molay gave himself up. He knew that this was going to happen, and he gave himself up for the good of the order. And so I think there were many others that probably did the same thing. But, you know, like I say, 600 men sounds like a lot of men, and it is a lot of men. But in the grand scheme of the size of the total order, and you got to remember, the Cistercians were also part of it. There were tens of thousands of Cistercian monks. The Templars were Cistercian monks. They just served a different function within the order. Obviously, they were the ones that carried the sword, the swords, and so they were very powerful. And as long as you've got a military force behind you, you're going to be a force to be reckoned with, and certainly the Cistercians were. But not coincidentally, when the Templars were disbanded, this also led to the beginning of the downfall of the Cistercians. So it was a significant blow, but it was far from the death knell to the order.
Yeah, I agree. And in fact, I mean, one of my ideals here is that there are those walking amongst us that we refer to as the white knights that are on the planet right now as we speak, that are doing a lot of the behind the scenes assistance in bringing down this maniacal matrix. And I do believe the Templars are behind it. That's just my opinion.
Well, I can tell you that, you know, when they're initiated, they have a certain, they take a vow to do certain things. Yes. And, in my opinion, those vows are to do positive things in the world. So however they do that, I think every person who is either a Templar Knight or a Freemason takes a vow to do positive things to try to make the world a better place. Now, there's many ways to accomplish that. There's many different avenues that need to be addressed. So it's not all, and not everybody is doing the same thing. But in the end, I think everybody's like-minded to try to make this world a better place. And that can encompass a lot of different things, done in a lot of different ways.
So, Scott, did you research anything more about the original three that came together to start the whole Templar Foundation? And how
well, I don't think it's that simple. I think okay. if you look at the history of it, if you can get all of the history, it's very hard because a lot of the activities of some of those original Venus family members it's not easy to find if you can find it at all. There were a lot of things that went on in the planning of this order and the Cistercians that it simply was not written down. But if you know who to look for and who these people are and you research their activities, you can learn an awful lot about how this whole thing came together. But it didn't start in 1100. This ideology has been around for 1,000 years prior. Mm-hmm. It was just operating under the radar. And it's unless you know what to look for, it's very difficult to you know, fully understand it and appreciate it.
Yeah. Now, how do you feel about this? I was wondering if also what they found under the temple was mm-hmm. in fact very detailed information about how the world would be compromised by very dark agendas and how there was actually a plan to counter that darkness. And it
well,
was
I don't know if that particular I don't know if that specific information was in there. I guess it could, you know, perhaps it could be interpreted that way. But in general, there were documents that talked about things that had happened in the historical past. There were maps, there was genealogy, there were official documents, and navigation devices, certain technologies, and remains, as well as gold. I think the Ark was one of the relics. I think the golden menorah was one of the relics. There were many things that were down there. It wasn't all just one thing. Exactly what was in those documents, exactly what's in, you know, the maps and everything, that we simply don't know. I can speculate, but I think it helped them with their secret operations on other continents, including the Americas. And I mean, if you look at it, one of the really interesting books that very few people are even aware of is Jacques de Mayeu wrote a book, I think it was in 1971, and it was written in French, Italian, and Spanish, I believe, not in English. And I still don't think it's been translated into English, but it's called Le Templars in America.
Interesting.
And it was a really good book. It had a lot of some of the standard stuff that you often read about the operations of the natives or of the Templars over here in the Americas. But one of the interesting things that I got out of it was, one, it seemed that during the, 12th, 13th, 14th centuries, that the Templars always had freshly minted silver and gold. And the silver sources in the Americas had been depleted at the time, you know, in medieval times. I mean, they'd been around in Europe for thousands of years and mining those sources. But Templars always had fresh silver and gold. And the question is, where did they get it? The other thing that was interesting is the many people at the time, including the church, were confused as to why the Templars were so obsessed with their shipping enterprise and their ports on the western part of France, like at La Rochelle, when they had southern ports in the Mediterranean, and this was basically where the center of the shipping activity and trade was taking place, yet they were obsessed with their western port, that if you look on a map to get into the Mediterranean, it makes more sense to sail from the southern ports instead of sailing all the way around the Iberian Peninsula just to get into the Mediterranean, and then a third of the way just to get back into where the hub of activity was in the Mediterranean. So the question is, why were they obsessed with that port? Well, the answer is obvious. They weren't going to the Mediterranean. They were going west.
I was actually thinking, too, that there's probably a note, some specific PowerPoint on the planet.
And a that, PowerPoint?
Yeah, like a note or a ley line.
Oh, well, yeah, there's certainly ley lines. And they definitely had the ability to pick up on gravity highs and density and differing densities and geological formations. It's interesting, too, that if you want to find unusual artifacts or sites, we have a disproportionately high percentage of them that occur at meteorite impact locations.
Wow.
Extraterrestrial impacts. Yep.
Very interesting.
Yes, it is. How did they know that? Well, they were able to pick up on the gravity highs. And the concentration, oftentimes when you have an intrusion into the crust of the Earth, this will set up convection currents of magma, and it will concentrate base metals along those fracture lines. So a lot of those high gravity areas tend to have minerals like gold and silver.
Very good point. Wow, thank you for that. So back to the Templars taking ships back and forth to the Americas.
Mm-hmm.
How far back do you think that was actually going? Do you think this was happening before the Templars actually were called the Templars? And there was
Of course. Yeah, I mean, look, you've got the Tucson lead artifacts, which are 32 lead artifacts that have Latin and Hebrew on them. They've got Masonic symbols. They've got all kinds of information on them, and they've been dismissed. But what people don't understand is that the veracity of and the provenance of those artifacts is absolutely perfect. They're absolutely genuine. These are definitely made by Venus family members because they. The only place where you would have a Roman Jewish colony in the 8th and 9th century, which is where these artifacts date back to, is in the southern region of southern France, in the same area where the Templars were founded. These are their ideological ancestors. Then you go and look at artifacts like the Bat Creek Stone, which dates back to the 1st century, Paleo-Hebrew. How did that get there? How did that get into a Native American burial mound? And the only reason that artifact that we know about it today is because the Smithsonian screwed up. They thought it was a Paleo-Cherokee artifact. They didn't perceive it as a threat to the paradigm. And then in the 1960s, 70 years after it was found, over 70 years, it was realized that it was actually Paleo-Hebrew, not Paleo-Cherokee. Wow. And of course, the Smithsonian's immediate reaction wasn't, well, this is interesting, maybe we should take a closer. Their reaction was, it's a hoax. And they've maintained that position ever since, even though the scientific testing of the related artifacts, including C-14 and metallurgy testing, have proven that it dates back to between the 6th and 1st centuries.
Wow.
Now, yeah, it's amazing. But you know what? I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised at all. Yeah. And believe you me, if they didn't get that one, what else did they find that they've tucked away in the archives? A lot of people don't realize this, but in the early days, the Smithsonian Institute was largely financed by the Roman Church.
Doesn't surprise me either. I mean, anything.
They hate my guts for obvious reasons.
Hey, Scott, that shows you're doing something right, you know?
Oh, absolutely. Look, the more they...
They hate my guts.
There's plenty of haters out there, and the more that they hate on me, the more I know that I'm doing something right.
That's too funny. So do me a favor. You continue to refer to the Venus family. Can you clarify for the audience who and what that is?
Well, the Venus families are a group of people who are ideologically connected. They are genealogically connected, and they are the ones, in large part, they are either directly descended to these lines of people that come from Jesus and their family members and their supporters. But people who have maintained this ideological thread and these secrets within their families for a long time. They've operated much like the monarchies do today, that they have consolidated their genealogy, consolidated their power and their wealth, and have continued to try to perpetuate this ideology that they embrace, that goes back to Jesus, Mary Magdalene, John the Baptist, and all the way back to the Egyptians, including Akhenaten and his followers. So that's who these people are, and they during the and if you look at, you know, the legends of Mary Magdalene, that she escaped into southern France, you know, and she was, if you believe some of the legends, that she was pregnant at the time and probably remarried and had children, that these lines probably disseminate from her and her descendants and some of her other family members, maybe Jesus's family, brothers and sisters, and maybe some of her brothers and sisters.
Right.
So,
which would also tie in with the, I think there's a parallel between the 12 tribes versus the 12 different lines.
Well, and the 12 could also be symbolic of the 12 primary constellations of the zodiac.
Right.
It doesn't necessarily have to be one thing. It could be multiple things. And of course, symbolism is a very important way of transferring information and preserving information, as you know.
Yes.
So, but when we talk about Venus, the reason we call them, and when I say we, I'm talking about Janet and Alan Butler and Bill Mann and some of the other people that we do research with, is because the basis of their ideology goes back to the veneration of the sacred feminine, which the sacred feminine has always, the physical manifestation of the goddess in the heaven has always been Venus. And when you look at Venus has very important cycles that are very precise, and they have been used by ancient cultures for millennia to keep track of the movement of the stars, the planet, the earth. And Venus is the third brightest heavenly body in the sky, and when you understand its movements, you understand its cycles, you understand the symbols that it makes, and how important it was to these people that embraced this ideology, you understand why we call them the Venus families.
Interesting. Thank you for that clarification. Now, what about the family of Lorraine?
Well, they would be Venus family people.
Okay. Same thing.
For sure.
And now, King Philip IV, now it's suggested that he actually tried to become a member of the Knights Templar, and he was rejected.
Philip the Fair?
Yes.
Yep. Yeah, he was. He was. And I don't know exactly what the details were, but that's one of the stories about him, that he had an axe to grind because he wasn't found worthy of being a Templar Knight. And I'm sure that played a role in how things played out.
That's what I was going to say. I was wondering if you had found any research on what was the true, I guess one of my big red flags is, what was the true luring to bring the Templars from Rome to France? I think it was Avignon, right?
Well, are you talking about why Jacques de Molay ended up in France, which led to his arrest? I mean, he was there attending a funeral.
No, I'm talking about like in the very beginning when King Philip supposedly contacted them and asked them for assistance because he really needed more money. And they were supposedly headquartered at the time out of Rome at that point or something.
And well, no, I think at that time, I mean, with Philip the Fair, at that time, their headquarters was in Paris.
Interesting.
Yeah, and that was one of the things after the put-down. They destroyed that Templar castle, and it was right there in France. I've been there, and of course it no longer exists, but they marked the spot, and right next to it, a block away, was a very important Venus family church called St. Martin's de Champs, and that, boy, you take a look at that. There are Merovingian family members that are buried in the bowels of that church.
Wow.
And a lot of those people that supplied money that eventually would go towards the founding of the Cistercians and the Templars are buried in that church. It's a very important church with a lot of sacred information. And of course, you look at the church itself. It's really it's interesting. And actually, what it is now, it's no longer an active church. It's actually a museum of the history of science in Europe. And it's really a neat place to go visit. And actually, that's more appropriate than people realize, because at the core of Templarism, at the core of Freemasonry, at the core of what these Venus families really believed and embraced was science, mathematics, and geometry, as well as astronomy. So they were first and foremost very intelligent. They believed in education. They believed in knowledge, and knowledge is power. So that was, you know, that was very important to these people.
I also read that they were major sticklers about archaeology because they felt that was where the root of truth existed about the history of this planet.
Oh, sure. So, absolutely. I mean, you dig in the ground and you find the evidence of these ancient cultures and what they did, what they believed, where they lived. And, you know, I've always said the same thing, you know. The only way to go forward into the future intelligently is you have to know where you've already been. You need to know the truth about where you've been. And I think that's why today there is so much change and so many things happening, because we're, in my opinion, we're at a very critical juncture in our species history. And we need to make some tough decisions about how we're going to go forward into the future. It's a fact. We have too many people on this planet. We cannot keep going the way we are, or we're going to run into even more serious problems. And if we're as smart as we think we are, as we tell ourselves all the time, we should be able to figure that out and make, appropriate changes. And I'm not talking about killing people, but I think education is the key. We need to educate everybody. Get everybody on an equal level. It's a fact. It's a scientific fact that the more educated people are, especially women, the fewer number of children they have.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's really the key. And, you know, we can talk about specific instances, but I would argue that that any radical religion, not just the radical Muslim religions right now that are getting all the negative press, there's plenty of other religions that have warts and are, I think, teaching poor messages to some of their constituents. Anytime you have people being taught the wrong things, it just leads to problems with humanity. And we're seeing it right now.
Yeah, well, you know what? If you keep doing the same thing over and over again and you expect a different response,
you know what they call that?
It's like, come
they
on,
call that man. they call that insanity or being crazy. Yeah.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, back to what you said about the Algonquins,
the Algonquin nation.
My heart just leapt because one of the missions that I was sent on cross country was all about them.
Mm-hmm.
Everywhere I went. And I'd like to hear a little more. I mean, what was their relationship with the Templars? Do you know?
Well, they were blood brothers. That's what they called them to me. They said that they were blood brothers. They literally shared their blood. They intermarried. They shared rituals. They shared knowledge. And look, the Templars warned the natives that the Christians were coming and that it wasn't going to be good. And that's why they left their cities and they went wild, as it were. They had a prophecy that said that they had to go wild. And I think it was nothing more than they did what they thought would give them the best chance to survive by disseminating. And, you know, it's interesting, you know, a lot of the archaeologists will tell you that places like Cahokia and the mound building cultures around the country, the cities where, you know, these people would interact and trade and live, that they abandoned them around 1300. And some archaeologists say, oh, they overfished, they overhunted, they chopped down all the trees. And I just laugh and say, really? All of a sudden they got stupid right before contact? I don't think so. Yeah. They knew what was coming. They were warned.
Right.
And I mean, the Templars knew how these guys operated, and they knew what they were going to do to the natives. And it's exactly how it all played out. So this is also part of the reason why we don't know, and why, I mean, I've had certain natives when I've gained their trust and I start talking to them, and God, sometimes I just get to a point where I go, how come nobody knows this? And they look at me and say, you never asked.
God, now that's sad.
It is sad. I mean, but it's true. And I've heard that more than once. And I'll tell you what, the one thing about Native people that I absolutely love is, you know, in general, do they have an axe to grind with white people? Of course they do. And it's absolutely understandable. But if you spend time with them, you respect their culture, and you listen, they're like anybody else. You treat them the way that you want to be treated, they'll respond in kind.
Yes.
And I'll tell you what, they have been wonderful with me, and I have nothing but good words to say about them. And look, I'll tell you, if somebody treats me like a jerk, they're going to get it right back. I mean, I think anybody else would behave the same way. And, you know, it's just basic human interactions. Treat people the way you want to be treated, and
golden rule, isn't it, Scott?
And, well, it's not it's not magic, is it?
No, it's not. And the other thing that's so fascinating is a gentleman by the name of Kevin Annette has really exposed the maniacal genocide and elimination of all the Aboriginal children of the local Indians in Canada. I mean, he has done work on this by none other than the Catholic Church. So,
oh, absolutely.
There you go again. There's another connection of wanting to take out that pure, you know, Templar related / Indian blood.
Well, don't forget, when the Templars came over here, they were the bloodline. So when they talk about their blood brothers, one of the goals of the Templars was to intentionally put the bloodline into the natives to protect it.
Wow.
Over here.
I never thought about that.
I mean, think about that. It's so simple, and it just makes so much sense, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And that's another reason why the American Indians are also so revered, is they do have phenomenal gifts. I've had many, many friends that are American Indian. They have just an amazing sensitivity and clairsentience, just these gifts that are.
Yes, and they have a way of digging deep inside themselves and being one with, you know, their surroundings and nature and all that. And I mean, you know, some people start to think that it's all hocus pocus or woo-woo stuff. But hey, listen, it's nothing more than being respectful of your surroundings and trying to live in balance. And that's not woo-woo. That's just common sense. But so many people are quick to criticize and attack this way of living and thinking. And it's just sad. It's like, you know, they want to live. Everybody wants to live and do what they want to do and be respected. And it goes both ways. So, you know, it's not a one way street. And the natives, we can learn an awful lot from them. And it's sometimes I'm amazed at how tolerant and patient they are in dealing with, you know, some of us that treated them so poorly.
So tell me a little bit, do you know much about the Templars' involvement with the Magna Carta?
Not specifically. That isn't something I've really spent much time researching, but I'm sure they, in one way or another, had their hands involved in it.
I mean, just by talking with you, it just still boggles my mind how much of what you're discussing is paralleling the new Earth that we are attempting to create.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's all based on sovereignty, acknowledging all different cultures, putting to rest the hatred and the resentment, living with the land and honoring Mother Earth. I mean, so on and so forth.
This is just basic stuff.
Sure.
And I don't think it's unique to Templarism or to any other particular group. I think it's just a common sense thing. Now, there are certain groups that obviously embrace these ideals and act upon them more than others. And I would say that Masonic groups fall into that category and Templar groups fall into that category. But, you know, we should all be doing that. That shouldn't be unique to any particular person. I mean, deep down, I think everybody enjoys nature. They understand we all want to have clean water and clean air. But I think sometimes people forget that we all have to take a role in that process if we want to end up with a positive outcome. And it can't just be everybody else taking care of it and we all enjoy the benefits. We all have to take a responsibility and a role in doing that. And sometimes it's just as simple as making sure you clean up after yourself, you know, you recycle and you know, basic stuff like that. And I don't see that as some magic concept, but everybody has to be involved. It can't just be some. And of course, big business and government has to play a role in that as well. And I think that what we can do as citizens is we can make sure that we elect the people that is part of their agenda, that they make sure that those kind of, you know, laws are passed that take care of our planet. Because at the end of the day, if we don't take care of our planet, nothing else matters. What else is more important than, you know, where you live and eat and breathe and the water you drink? I mean, this isn't rocket science, for crying out loud.
Yeah, and this is why the sleeping giant awakening is scaring the hell out of the so-called, you know, puppeteers. I was going to say, I think the other fascination about the Templars too is because of the fact that they sort of represented the whole European community, the Caucasian community, which was typically not as, I'm going to use the word, attached or involved or intuitively aware of our amazing connection with our planet, with our Earth.
Well, you know, the only thing I would disagree with as far as what you just said is that it wasn't all just white people. I mean, to be a Templar Knight,
that's true.
It didn't matter. You had to make a vow of certain things, and it didn't matter if you were a white person.
Correct.
or you were of Italian or you were Jewish or, you know, you were Israeli or even Muslim for that matter. Some of the, you know, the, you know, you had to be a Christian, of course, but it didn't matter where you came from. You didn't have to necessarily be a white guy. You could really be anything as long as you took that vow. That's how it is in Freemasonry. They don't care. They don't even care what religion you are. The only thing that you're asked to do as a Freemason is make a statement about a belief in a higher power. Who and what that higher power is nobody else's business. That's your business. But they do want you to say that you believe in a deity. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, people can debate what they want about deity, but we're all talking about the same thing. And who you call it, whether it's male or female or whatever, it's the same thing that we're all talking about. It's that thing that's out there that makes the plants grow, that makes the sun shine, and you know, that thing that makes us human and who we are, and all the animals and everything else. And so to me, that's a uniting thing. It's one of the things that all of us on this planet have in common. We're all talking about that same God or deity, whatever you want to call it. And your deity isn't any better than mine or somebody else's. It's the same thing.
You know, I've read that they were very universal. You know, all different kinds of nationalities and cultures were incorporated into the temple.
Yes.
And I know that the initiation greatly involved, you know, their tendency to be corrupted or not. You know, obviously, if you were corruptible, you were not considered a prime candidate for the Templars. But I also wanted to go over with you just some of the research you've done on the actual life of the Templars, because I found it very interesting that, this is what I read, so you tell me what you found. I read that the Templars were actually, they were promoted to marry. But if they were to marry, they wanted them to marry a woman who was very involved in humanitarian concepts, who really had a spiritual, you know, thread within her. And they even went so far as to the time that the Templars were sent out to battle, those wives were actually placed under protective custody.
Right. Yep. Well, you know, let's face it. I mean, part of perpetuating an order is you have to have new blood, right?
Right.
So even though they were pious, it doesn't mean that they were celibate. And I mean, that's just not practical in any society. You have to procreate to continue operations over time. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think what you've read is pretty clear. I know that the Templars were also had at least 15 to 20 monks that actually served them in a capacity of taking care of their equipment, taking care of their horses, taking care of their swords, and making sure that they had everything they needed to be, you know, to have the proper training and support. Within the Cistercian order, they were the only ones allowed to eat meat because they needed the protein, obviously, for strength. So there was something unique about being a Templar. They had to have certain, they all had to have certain mental and spiritual attributes. They also had to have a proper physical training. I mean, it was a different thing for them, but at the end of the day, they were all monks and all part of this, you know, this order. But they had to procreate, and these guys were physically superior. So, you know, I guess you'd be remiss to not understand that they also understood that there were certain genetic traits that they wanted to procreate and continue on. And if you had a big, strong, tough SOB, you know, you want to be sure that those genetics were passed on.
So obviously you agree that they were like a kind of a holy militia. And I think the question I have for you is, at what point did they determine that a battle was worthy?
Oops, I think my phone's going to go dead here. I'm going to have to grab the other one. Hang on.
Okay.
Anyway, I think, you know, look, it was like anything else. I mean, you, if you're in a military, you evaluate your strategic situations and your enemies. And when you decide that, you know, it takes force to accomplish your objectives, and then you mount a crusade, or you initiate a battle. It's very similar to what our military does today. I don't think it's any different at all.
Well, thought they might have a little more, they might be a little bit more particular in choose the battles that they...
Yeah, pick their battles carefully.
They were sought after so much.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think they did. They didn't just blindly go into any conflict and just say, hey, God's on our side, we're going to win, so let's go. We just have to show up. I mean, obviously that's not the case. I mean, they were very brilliant strategists, and they understood their enemies, and they picked their battles carefully. So I you know, you'd have to look at each known conflict and examine them, you know, to know the details about why they did a particular conflict. But in general, they were very smart. And, you know, you don't hear about them losing too many battles. They certainly did lose battles, but they were brilliant warriors. And, you know, even if they were losing, you know, if they lost a conflict, their enemies respected them for their bravery and you know, their strength. So they were a formidable force throughout their whole existence. There's no question about it.
I think I also read that they were just incredibly honorable, even at the time, at the end yep. of the battle, they would go to the enemy's king or leader and say, you know, try to make amends and wish them. Yeah. I mean, it was incredible.
Yeah, no, that in many ways, it's like being a good sport, you know, in a sporting contest. You know, you could beat the guys on the other side, but at the end of the day, they have families and children, and you know, they want to go back to just like everybody else does. And I think that they, for the most part, appreciated that. But, you know, when the game is on, it's tough going. And then when it's over, it's over. And I think the same is true in war, you know?
Yeah. So, Scott, what is the story behind their, apparently they were sought after quite a bit by the royal families at that time?
By the monarchs?
Yeah, by the monarchs, excuse me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, well, they would have been, you know, they were sort of a love-hate relationship, because when the monarchs had difficulties and conflicts, sometimes they would go to the Templars, and they were basically commissioned or contracted out as hired guns. And I don't think that certain factions within the Templars were above being paid for their services. So I think that, you know, that happened in Portugal. And that happened in other places. So, but on the other hand, you know, the Templars were also in consort with the Cistercians, who, on their abbeys, they were producing massive amounts of food, wool for clothing. They had foundries. They were making tools, and they were making all kinds of products that they would sell to different vendors in the fairs throughout France. And they were basically capitalists, and they made a ton of money. And so they were undermining the feudalistic system of Europe, and the Templars were part of that by trafficking the goods. They were basically the long-haul truckers. So this was something that would agitate, you know, the monarchs and the royals. And so, again, it was a love-hate relationship. But at the same time, what are you going to do, come down on the monks? I mean, you really have to be careful about how you do business. And, you know, you always had to worry about those guys with the swords. So at one point, if you're upset with them, the next day, all of a sudden, situation can change and you need them. So, you know, be careful how you treat people, because things can change in a hurry.
You know, I was wondering if you had an opinion on the way in which they used the Catholic Church. You know, I mean, let me back up. I think it's interesting. Catholic means universal, and it's actually the way in which they operated within their own. I forgot what they call them, but they had gatherings and groups throughout all the different countries. And one of the things that they've been under so much criticism about is how they were so wealthy, and they had so much land and a lot of castles, et cetera, et cetera. But from what I've determined from the readings I've done, is these were used very strategically for as like their own sovereign, independent state towns
right.
for their own operations. So, I mean, it was absolutely brilliant. The way
it was brilliant.
People to get sovereignty from the Catholic Church, not pay tax towards them, especially energetically. They didn't want to contribute to the beast.
Well, and remember something, they were the leadership and the ones that were pulling the strings were ideologically opposed, and their plan was absolutely brilliant, and they nearly pulled off, overtaking and destroying the Catholic Church from within. And this is what, and I believe that the church saw it. I believe the monarch saw it, and they knew that they had to do something or they were going to be in trouble. These guys are going to take over. And the one thing that I don't know for sure was, was America the backup plan, or was that the main goal all along, was to establish their quote New Jerusalem over here that we now call the United States of America? I think in the end that even though they were trying hard to overthrow the monarchs of Europe and the Roman Church, I really believe that their long range goal was to establish a new place with their strategic allies, the natives, and of course the church and the other forces followed them over here, and it didn't go according to plan, at least not perfectly, but eventually I think we could say that they did accomplish their objective. So yeah, it's a complicated story, and it's there's a lot of details that need to be unraveled, but the general story, I think we can all see how it all played out.
Well, and there too, it seems like they had an uncanny ability to know timing, to know their destiny, especially because of the artifacts and the information they stumbled upon at the time of the temple, and digging.
I don't think they stumbled upon anything.
I think they knew exactly
what they were looking for, and they knew where to find it.
Good point. That's a good point.
Because that information had been passed on through these secret societies within a very exclusive group for almost 2,000 years. In fact, one of the new discoveries that I've just made since becoming a Mason was in one of the rituals. I discovered the numbers on the Kensington Runestone are within a certain ritual that told me exactly who had the knowledge and how it was passed to the Templars. And that's why they fought the First Crusade, to control the perimeter of the city, to go into the Talpiot tomb, to get the bones that would be their insurance card, and then to dig under the temple to get the things, to get the treasures. You know, in the ritual you learned there were copies of all the treasures, including the Ark. There was more than one Ark. In fact, the original Ark was probably down below in the ninth arch. And so every time they were pillaging the Babylonians and such that pillaged the temple, the treasures they took weren't the original treasures. They were copies. And nobody knew that the stuff was still down below, and it was there the whole time. But the Templars got that information passed along to them. That's why they mounted the First Crusade. It was a military mission to control the city, to dig under the temple and go into the tomb. And who knows what else they were doing there.
Amazing.
But it was, and then they gave it up. They didn't even have the Holy Land for a century before they gave it up the first time. So once you've accomplished your objective, and then you don't need the territory, and if it's not worth the casualties or not worth the money that you and effort you have to put in to maintain it, then let it go.
Interesting. Yeah, and a couple of temples have been purchased, have been built on top of that temple.
That's right. So, and the whole time, when people thought that they had taken the treasures, the best stuff was still sitting down below and nobody knew it.
Wow. So it was all about the information and the knowledge.
Well, it was passed on mouth to ear.
That's amazing. Now you talk a lot about the rituals. Can you share some of the basics with us?
Well, I'm not supposed to, so okay. I'll honor my pledge, but look, Freemasonry is about moral allegory and sacred geometry. Those are the two main principles. And this is the same stuff that the Venus families embraced and were teaching and wanted people to know. So when you become initiated into any Masonic organization. The whole idea is to make good people better people.
Mm-hmm.
Doing that through education and through knowledge and moral teachings and education. It all boils down to that.
So where, at what point did everything appear, if not did, become corrupted? You know, when you hear the 33rd degree Masons and you hear all about the politicians and how, you know, they're just up to their eyeballs in this very demonic, ritualistic type of process that they do.
Well, quite frankly, I don't know what you're talking about. I'm not a 33rd degree Mason. I'm a 32nd degree Scottish Rite Mason. And I can promise you that there isn't any New World Order within the guys that I know. There might be some side order that Masons are part of, but that's not part of Freemasonry that I know. And so I think a lot of that is BS. And I think a lot of the people that are pulling the strings, as you said, and I do believe there are people at the top that pull the strings and have a lot more influence than they should, but I guess that's the way it is. Some are Masons probably, and some are not.
Okay.
So this is not, look, if there's a New World Order that's within Freemasonry, I've never seen it. And I would know.
Yes.
I would know.
And I interviewed a woman named Louise. I will try to put that link up with this interview, but she is so on fire to educate the world that the Freemasons are a very positive group of people, that they've gotten a bad rap, that they have phenomenal knowledge and wisdom to disperse to the planet, that they are here to assist, and just completely aligned with what you just said.
Well, she's right on. And that has been what my experience is. And I would not join an organization that did anything that was negative or oppressing anybody else. I just wouldn't be involved in that. And I can guarantee you that's not the case.
Well, and
I mean, we've been accused of doing a lot of things, but
yes.
90% of it is all BS. And I wish we had as much influence as people think.
Now, at what point did the Masons branch off of the Templars? Clarify that for us.
Well, after the put down, you had people that just went under the radar. They would meet in secret. I personally believe that the Knights Templar evolved into, shortly thereafter, into the Rosicrucian Order. And if you look at people, if you know who some of the people are that were Rosicrucians, I can tell you this, Thomas Jefferson was a Rosicrucian. Thomas Jefferson said the three greatest men ever to walk the planet were Isaac Newton, John Locke, and Francis Bacon. They were founding members of the Rosicrucian Order in Europe, and their ideology is absolutely Templarism, Venus family, and Masonic. And so those are the guys probably within certain Rosicrucian orders that had some of the real secrets that were passed on. And I believe Thomas Jefferson, Ben Franklin, you know, they were members of the Lodge of Nine Sisters in France. And they were running with people there that are known to be Rosicrucians. So that's where this transfer took place. And these Masonic organizations existed long before Freemasonry had its coming out party in 1717 in London. But if people think that's when Freemasonry started, they couldn't be more wrong. Freemasonry as an institution, as a philosophy, has existed going back to Egypt and beyond. There's a reason why we use so much Egyptian symbolism. But when you become a Mason, you learn about all cultures. You learn about all religions. You certainly learn about the Jewish Kabbalah. And the whole basis for Masonry and doing these degrees is to learn. It's about seeking light, knowledge. And it's wonderful. And I'm so glad I did it, because it led to this discovery of the ritual code on the Kensington runestone, and now I know exactly what the runestone is. I know what part of it's real and what part is allegory, is not real. And it's just incredible. And it's an amazing document. It's absolutely 14th century, and it was carved by a very enlightened, initiated Cistercian monk. Wow. And that inscription was laid out long before they got to what is now Kensington.
Now, Scott, for those of you that are listening that are not aware, Scott was involved with the forensic evidence during the World Trade Center 9/11.
No, not World Trade Center. I worked on the Pentagon.
Ah, okay. Thank you for that clarity.
I was not involved at Ground Zero. I've been there. I was approached by some of the forensic engineers that were working at Ground Zero. In fact, a couple days after it collapsed, one of my good friends and clients, Dave Peraza, called me, and he was standing on the pile. He was walking through the rubble, and he said, "Can you do anything with concrete dust?" And I said, "Not really, Dave. I need intact pieces." But he said when that building collapsed, it reduced all the concrete to dust. It was just that catastrophic of a failure. Just incredible.
Absolutely insane. Well, and that's what I was going to ask you. Now, supposedly you tell us a little bit about the, I don't want to screw it up,
petrography work, yeah. Well, basically petrography, the type of work I do, forensic geology, is I essentially do autopsies on concrete and rock. That's the simplest way to explain it to a layperson. So I only get involved when something goes wrong. You know, the concrete cracks, it has low strength, freeze thaw damage, delaminations, fire damage, as was the case at the Pentagon. And that was what they wanted us to focus on at the Pentagon, was to evaluate the concrete to see how hot the fire got at certain depths within the concrete. And if it reached a certain temperature at the level of the reinforcing steel, then what that meant was the strength of the steel, or the yield, would be lost, and therefore it had to come out. And so the whole idea was for us to, the original plan was to do a surgical type of repair at the Pentagon. This one can be repaired. That one gets torn out. This one's okay. Mm. And it turned out in the end that there was enough damage to these concrete members, to these structural beams and columns, that they just decided to tear it all out along the construction joints and start over. So it was a much worse, but it was a very hot fire. It was a jet fuel fire. It was absolutely a plane that hit the Pentagon, and it did a lot more damage than anybody realized.
You've probably taken a ton of heat on that. I mean,
well, I haven't taken any heat because I haven't done anything, but I've had a lot of people ask questions, and
Because Scott, the reason I say that is because so much of the information out there is saying that there was no plane that truly, really hit in the way that they stated it did.
Well, that's not correct. It was absolutely a plane that hit the Pentagon. I have pictures of the parts of the plane, landing gear, parts of the jet engine. It absolutely was a plane. One of my best friends was a first responder who was on scene within 40 minutes after the attack, right as the collapsed area fell, and I can promise you it was a plane.
Mm. Well, we'll just put that one to rest, won't we?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, you know, I have a whole lecture on the work we did at the Pentagon and the reconstruction afterwards. And if I took you through it, you would see pretty quickly that's what it was. I can tell you this: the very first samples that showed up at my office after we were assigned to the Pentagon. I remember the very first morning that I walked into my office, I could smell the jet fuel down the hallway before I even got to my office.
Wow.
I'll never forget that smell. So And I know what jet fuel smells like, and I don't think they doused it before they sent the samples just to throw me off.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, not to switch gears, but to bring you back to the Knights Templar, I was wondering, do you feel that all of the events that you were covering in your show, in your TV show,
in America on Earth?
Yes.
Yeah?
I just loved it. But as I stated the last time I interviewed you, I mean, it was just so apparent to me that you were destined to be the one to follow all the cookie crumbs and put all of this together. Can you just kind of surmise for the audience, especially if they're just coming in on this interview, what you connected with what? Because to me, it was just like, wow.
Well, which episode are you talking about? I mean, there was...
Well, just start from the beginning. I mean, I don't expect you to do like an hour dissertation, but just kind of connect the dots for those that didn't see the whole thing.
Well, I mean, you know, thank you, honey. Each episode we did was really a standalone episode. I mean, there was certain things that ended up intertwining. I mean, they weren't always unique and separate. But you know, if you look at each of the episodes that we did, we tried to look at them, you know, independently, objectively, and look at it from a scientific standpoint. I mean, I approached it, all those, the same way I approach any project. You know, the first thing you do is you gather your information, you collect as many facts as you can, and then you, once you've done that, you try to make the proper interpretations and hopefully be able to draw a conclusion. And in some cases, it worked really well. In other cases, it didn't work so well. I mean, we just didn't have enough facts. I mean, some people criticize me because I, you know, well, gee, you never draw a conclusion. Well, first of all, that's not true. We drew a conclusion many times. Most of the time we were able to draw a conclusion. But if there isn't enough evidence to draw a conclusion and it's not appropriate to draw a conclusion, then you don't do it. So, you know, that was the basic model, and it's no different than the work that we do. But, you know, in the end, all these things that we investigated that turned out to be something, to be real, are all interconnected in some way. As I told you, we talked about the Bad Creek. We've talked about the Tucson lead artifacts. We talked about the runestones, the five North American runestones in this country that have the hooked X. They're all connected to the same group of people ideologically over, you know, 1,500 years of time. So what I'm getting at here is all these things that we looked at to some degree in America on Earth are all connected to each other in this giant matrix of interconnecting threads throughout time. So,
Well, Scott, talk to us about the hooked X. You know, give us a little bit of like, how is that connecting, you know, Jesus and the bloodline to say the pirates?
Well, that's a complicated question or answer to, you know, there's a lot to it, but the Hooked X represents that ideology first and foremost. It's a secret symbol that the Templars used, or the Venus families used, on the runestones in this country for the letter A. It goes back to the Hebrew Aleph, and it was a unique symbol that only they knew. And based on the recent discovery of the Hooked X Tau Cross monogram that's on the lid of the Jesus ossuary in the Talpiot tomb.
Couldn't believe it.
I still can't believe that either. I mean, that's just ridiculous. But that was the secret symbol, and I always knew it was their secret symbol. I just didn't know where it came from. But now I know where it came from. I know why they used it, because it was a symbol of reverence to Jesus and Mary, because the symbol actually represents both. And the continuation, the hook, which creates a little V or a little girl, a child, inside the womb of the big V, which represents the mother, Mary Magdalene in this case, or the goddess, it doesn't matter. She's just one of many goddesses representing the sacred feminine. But It represented the continuation, the perpetuation, the literal physical generation of that ideology and thought. And so this goes back to the same thing we've been talking about the whole time, is that we're talking about a group of people who embraced an ancient ideology of monotheistic dualism, and it's expressed beautifully with this symbol that is on the runestones here and on Jesus's ossuary in the Talpiot tomb in Jerusalem. It's incredible.
It is incredible. And then didn't you also find one of those on the big block of, wasn't it iron? It ended up being iron, not silver, under the
you mean the pirate treasure of the Ninth Temple? No, that wasn't a hooked X. That was a triple Tau.
Triple Tau.
Which is interesting because the Tau cross is also on the lid of the Jesus ossuary. The triple Tau is a it's a symbol. If you take three Taus and you come at it from three different directions, and you join them in the middle at the base, you form this triple Tau symbol, which is a very important symbol in York Rite Masonry, Freemasonry. So a very particular branch of Freemasonry, which happens to be more Christian in its presentation of the degrees than the Scottish Rite, Christian as in Christ.
And its representation, is it anything different than the hooked X? Is it still representing ultimately the same thing?
In the end, I think it does. It's consistent with, well, the Tau cross is actually an Egyptian symbol. It's actually the Ankh is a Tau cross with a handle on it. That's all it is. And it's a very important, very ancient symbol of resurrection. And the Tau cross goes back even further into Egypt. It was actually an instrument used to measure the height of the Nile in the spring, which would predict if there would be flooding or drought. Obviously, there would be starvation and death, but if it came in the right, in the wheelhouse, then it would be prosperity. So that evolved into a symbol of life and death in Egypt, and eventually the most important symbol in Egyptian symbolism.
Well, and the number three follows Mary Magdalene, the whole essence, energy, goddess, that whole thing.
Right, the Trinity.
Yeah, the Trinity, it's all over the place.
It's a very important symbol in Freemasonry as well. And as we said, it goes back to Templarism, and if you follow it back even farther, it goes to Jesus and Mary Magdalene. So here again, as a forensic person, what I look for are consistencies, and this is consistent from start to finish. And what that tells you is, it's right.
You did such a great job. Now, the Captain Kidd thing, I mean, what was the final analysis on Captain Kidd? Do you feel that he was actually like an underground Templar?
Well, he may have. I don't know that for sure. I haven't seen any direct evidence of that. I think that he probably got a raw deal. I think he got involved in something, and eventually the powers that be, the people he was working with, decided that for the good of the operation, whatever it was, that he was expendable. And so that's why he was taken out. And he was so quickly, it was a rush to judgment. But part of, you know, he probably knew a lot of information. They might have been worried that he would talk. And this is my own personal opinion, and I think he did end up getting a raw deal, but he's not the first guy who took one for the team, as it were.
And the ship that you were reviewing that no one could find a manifest on, and it disappeared.
You're talking about in Madagascar?
Yes.
Yep.
You know, what was the final upshot on that? Have you found any research on where that ended up and who ended up?
No, we have not followed up on that. History chose not to renew that show for financial reasons. They had a lot of money invested in it, and they did not want to renew the contract, is my interpretation, and so they killed it. And what I mean by that is, first of all, they didn't advertise the series until the day before it aired, and then they aired two episodes in a row, three Saturdays in a row, And on the third Saturday, they switched the airtime from 8 o'clock, where the previous four episodes had aired, to 4 in the afternoon. So they killed it. And
sounds political to me, Scott.
It was financial. That's not political. Well, there was a political aspect to it, too.
I was going to say, I don't know.
Well, the political aspect was UNESCO that got involved. As soon as the silver bar was found, they started making a bunch of proclamations about, well, you know, Barry Clifford is doing everything wrong, and blah, blah. You know, they whitewashed it before they even got down there. And, of course, you know, it became a self-fulfilling prophecy. But they didn't spend enough time to accurately map and process the site. They just wanted to kill it. And, you know, they said, well, the silver bar wasn't silver. It was lead. People were asking me about it. I never saw it. I mean, it was found after I was there. So I can't tell you what it was. But for my purposes in the show, it didn't matter if the symbol was carved in lead or carved in silver. It's still a triple tau. So I didn't care. But and the truth is, in context, if you look at the context of 1700 in the pirate culture, you could make the argument that the silver was more, or the lead was just as valuable as silver, if not more. All their lead shot they used in their guns were made of lead. They used lead for other purposes, and oftentimes they would use silver as ballast in their ships. So, you know, we think about it in today's context that silver has a high value, much more than lead, but back then, under those circumstances in that context, you could actually make the argument that a lead bar was more valuable than silver.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But, you know, UNESCO tried to paint it to be negative, and quite frankly, I thought it was inappropriate what they did, and I think UNESCO were a bunch of jerks. I thought that they treated Barry unfairly, and Barry can be a difficult guy, but he got a raw deal on that, and History Channel wanted nothing to do with it, so they just punted.
Wasn't that the reason why you guys were delayed for several days? Was UNESCO, they had to come in and look at it?
Well, that happened. That didn't delay me. Okay. That happened after we were done shooting the show. They went in after we were done shooting the show, and I wasn't part of any of that. But you know what? I'm just telling you what I think is this. You know, like I said, you know, Barry can be a difficult guy, but he was nice to me, and I consider him a friend. And he's certainly not a perfect person, but he absolutely got a raw deal by UNESCO. There's no question in my mind. He was treated very unfairly, and it was wrong. And UNESCO, they don't care about him. They just have their own agenda, and I wouldn't put anything past them. They'll do whatever is in their best interest to get done what they want, including doing things that are not ethical or lawful. And in this case, I thought that they were very unethical, the way that they handled this whole situation with Barry and those shipwrecks. Oh, that's not, they claimed that it wasn't Captain Kidd's ship. Well, look, it's an historical fact that the Adventure Galley was scuttled by Captain Kidd in Pirate Cove. There are five known shipwrecks there. One of them is Captain Kidd's ship. And Barry found two laying one on top of the other. I think there's a very good chance, based on the historical evidence that we had, that he did find the ship. I could care less. I mean, a lot of people, they think it's interesting because it's Captain Kidd, but his ship is there somewhere, and it was there. And I don't think UNESCO has any idea. I think they just said it wasn't because they wanted to put Barry down, which is BS.
It's all, you know, Scott, it's all part of just the cover-up.
Well, in this case, I would agree.
Got way too close to the truth. And in my opinion, you're one of the first shows on public TV that has actually made a connection between the ossuaries of Jesus and Mary's family, all the way to the Knights Templar, all the way to the pirates. They were probably freaking out.
Well, you know what? I don't really care about that. I just, you know, I'm trying to get the answers based on what the facts tell us. And
right.
You know what? If it's not politically expedient for some people, well, sorry.
Well, you ended up getting, what, six of those episodes off the ground?
Well, we, you mean, oh, yeah, you mean with the pirate treasure?
Yeah.
Yeah, six episodes.
Okay, so just so everyone knows, let me tell the public, you can tune in to America Unearthed. You can see it on YouTube, and there are six episodes. I highly recommend it. Scott Walter goes through the entire process with his team people and shows an amazing connection between all of these aspects, as I just stated. Well worth the time to watch it.
Well, good. Well, I appreciate the plug. I think you'll have to catch it on reruns, but it's definitely out there. So,
yeah,
and it's a good show. I mean, I think we did a good job. It was very difficult. It was hard to get permits from the Madagascar government for Barry to do his diving, and it was a challenge, but I think we put together a great show. We certainly shared some new information about the Templars. I thought the crew that I worked with, they were amazing. They were very professional. They worked their fannies off, and I think we found some really good stuff. So it was a good show, and I'm very proud of it.
Yeah, and I would highly recommend everybody checking it out. And Scott, do you have any other new information coming around the corner? I mean, are you writing a new book, or are you diving into other new investigations?
Well, yeah, there's a lot that's going on. Actually, I am working on a new book, and I also just formed a new production company with Hutton Pulitzer, a very, very polarizing guy to some people, but I'll tell you what, he's absolutely brilliant, and he is very passionate about getting to the truth about history. So it's a unique partnership, and we get along great, but we launched a new company called Explorer and Go Explorer, and it's a Hooked X, PL little r big r Explore.
Wow, you did the Hooked X thing, huh?
We use the Hooked X, and we use the dotted R at the end, because the dotted R proves the Kensington Runestone's a medieval artifact all by itself. And we are working on four major projects that we will be aggressively going after here in the coming days. And eventually we will put together some video productions that I think people will really, really enjoy. And it's going to be more serious. It'll be entertaining at the same time. I mean, I think people are entertained by a good investigation, and we will definitely draw conclusions. And I just bet you might see something about the tomb.
Oh, right on. Right on.
Just guessing. Just a guess.
Right on. Just a guess. Hint, hint, hint.
Just a guess. But anyway, I'm really excited about it, and Hutton is as well, and we're really having a great time. So,
well, Scott, if you know, I have so many other questions, but I could go on and on and on, and I want to thank you very much for just filling us with so much information, like a whole different perspective. I mean, that's what it gave me, was really connecting the historical dots, you know,
wow,
with what you did.
Well, we try hard. I can promise you that. And I think, all I can say is there's a lot more coming, so stay tuned.
Right on. Well, go ahead and give them your Blogspot web.
Yep. Yeah, and actually, you can read about the Hooked X Tal Cross. You can read about a lot of the new discoveries that we've made. I do post on my blog, and I let people chime in. And I let the trolls chime in, too. And I get plenty of people that troll my blog and try to be disruptive and negative. And I think we handle them in a fair and direct way. But anybody's welcome. I don't screen anybody out. But it's Scott Walter Answers. blogspot.com.
Right on.
And if they're interested in our in any of our books, including my wife's book, America, Nation of the Goddess, go to www.hookedx.com, spelled HOOKEDX.com.
Right on. And before I let you go, I have one last question.
Sure.
Even though I have a gazillion questions, but one less question. You know me. I have a lot of questions.
That's all right.
I am wearing kind of like a Templar cross today, just in honor of this interview. It was given to me by my father. He purchased it in Turkey. What was the reasoning behind the perfectly shaped cross?
The equilateral cross?
Yes.
Well, it depends on which one you're wearing, but the equilateral cross represents the four cardinal points, and there's all kinds of symbolism associated with that. But depending on which cross you have, you get it. Let's just say that it connects with geometry, and some of the and depending on which style of cross, you can actually date the cross, depending on how the ends of the arms are designed. And whether they flare in, they flare out, but it represents the four cardinal points, and there's all kinds of interesting Masonic symbolism that's associated with it and meaning. But it's a very beautiful thing. It's very important, and could write a book on an equilateral cross.
Yeah, and it tied in with one of your episodes. I think it was the fifth or sixth episode where you found, or maybe I'm getting it mixed up, you actually found this on one of the ancient temples, and it was shaped, you know, it kind of had a hump on the top, and then it was flat on the side, and it kind of tailored in.
Mm.
And it was where the light of the sun shone through like a hole in the side of the wall. And it was about the sun being the masculine energy and the church being the feminine womb energy.
That was the illumination event in the Newport Tower.
Okay.
Yeah, and it was an Orphic egg on the inside of the womb of the temple. The nave of the church is allegorical of the womb of the sacred feminine, and so the sun is a male deity. The sun came in and illuminated, framed out the egg on the winter solstice on the December 21st, mm-hmm. This allegorical union of male, female, heaven, and earth, representing dualism yet again, but it also signaled the return of the sun, the resurrection of the sun, and the days getting longer after the solstice.
Perfect. Well, next time I call you, I'm going to have to show you this cross because it has
a lot
more information behind it than what I'm alluding to.
Send me a picture.
I will. So,
all right.
Thank you so much, Scott. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. Again, you can catch this on BBS Radio Station 2 Tuesday afternoons from 3 to 4:55 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And as always, check out all of our services. We are world renowned for our implant removal process. There's three of them. We have a new amazing service coming out that is all about bringing you back to your divine blueprint. That's going to be introduced by Jeff Godfrey. And I have a new line that's going to be coming out any minute called Removing the Veil. So, with that, you guys stay tuned. Thanks for all of your support, love, and protection, because we do appreciate it and we do need it from time to time. So keep your love and your light coming. And as always, bless over Scott as well for the amazing work he's doing. So you guys take care and we'll have a good weekend, I hope. We'll talk to you soon.
All righty. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome, Scott.